Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing my story of the reign and achievements, glorious achievements of Henry V. Now, last time I left off, if you remember, just where he had become king. So we did his early life and his struggles with his own father, the usurper, Henry Bolingbroke. So, and I mentioned last time as well that he hits the ground running because he'd already had experience, essentially, of being the ruler, kind of, mostly, when his father had been more or less incapacitated by illness for a year or two, around 1410, 1411, the young Henry, the Prince of Wales, was doing all the business of government, really, sitting at the helm. So he'd had at least some experience of being the ruler, which goes a long, long way, right? Because sometimes, often, in fact, people think they want the top job, think they'll be great at the top job. And when they get there, they actually don't have the abilities and skills required. But Henry knew that he had what it took. And he's now sort of 25, 26 years old. So, you know, certainly not a child. He's been bloodied in war. He's got over 10 years experience, combat experience. So there's none of these worries of earlier kings where they have to, in sort of a weak piecemeal way, wrestle control of government away from anyone else. No, as soon as he becomes king, he can and does just start making policy and doing anything he wants. And so the story really begins in earnest at this point. In this episode, I do want to talk about the French side of the equation and all things religious as well, to kind of get those out of the way so we can focus entirely on Henry and his campaigns going forward. But before I do that, just a quick word from Churchill, Sir Winston Churchill, in his book, The History of the English-Speaking Peoples. His opening paragraph on Henry V is very good. He says this, quote, "A gleam of splendour falls across the dark, troubled story of medieval England. Henry V was king at 26. He felt, as his father had never done, sure of his title. He had spent his youth in camp and council. He had for 5 or 6 years intermittently conducted the government of the kingdom during his father's decline. The romantic stories of his riotous youth and sudden conversion to gravity and virtue, when charged with the supreme responsibility, must not be pressed too far. It may well be true that, quote, he was in his youth a diligent follower of idol practices, much given to instruments of music and fired with the torches of Venus herself, end quote. But if he had thus yielded to the vehement ebullitions of his nature, this was no more than a pastime, for always since boyhood he had been held in the grasp of grave business." So to say then, a very broad point is that the early 15th century in all of Europe is a very tumultuous time. You might think that England is having a bit of a rough go of it with the deposition and murder of the last Plantagenet, Richard II, and the usurper king, Henry IV, and all his wars with the Scots and the Welsh. And the Hundred Years' War is still simmering along. It's more in sort of a Cold War period, but it's absolutely still there. But further afield, it's the same. In the bit of land that we now call Germany was the Holy Roman Empire, this mishmash patchwork quilt of smaller kingdoms, all vying for each other and fighting amongst themselves all the time. And the church, the Orthodox Church, which I'll talk about in a bit, is also in a state of turmoil. There's a schism ever since the late 1370s. There's been a Western schism or a papal schism. And there's more than one pope running around, anti-popes. There's three, briefly even four popes. And all of that isn't even to mention that we're still living in the aftermath of the Black Death, the Great Pestilence, where some thought the world itself would even come to an end, where every single person would die of this disease. And now we're living in some sort of post-apocalyptic style semi-hellscape, the whole world just trying to claw itself back to where it had once been. Because even though there was that, the main Black Death, if you like, in the late 1340s, it kept coming back. It never really went away. So intermittently, every few years, there's just another wave of plague. So tumultuous times. And in the sphere of literature and art and architecture, we're also coming up to the Renaissance. Well, it is the early Renaissance in Italy. And the Germans and the French are catching on. And there are various revolutions in thought all over the place. So it's a time of change, very much so. A little Churchill go on briefly here saying this, quote, "In the surging realm, with its ailing king," that Henry IV is talking about there, "bitter factions and deep and social moral unrest, all men had for some time looked to him," Henry V, "and succeeding generations have seldom doubted that according to the standards of his day, he was all that a king should be. His face, we are told, was oval, with a long straight nose, ruddy complexion, dark smooth hair, and bright eyes, mild as a dove's when unprovoked, but lion-like in wrath. His frame was slender, yet well-knit, strong and active. His disposition, religious disposition, was orthodox, chivalrous and just. He came to the throne at a moment when England was wearied by feuds and yearned for unity and fame. He led the nation away from internal discord to foreign conquest, perhaps very deliberately. That's a trick as old as time. To take people's minds off of civil unrest is you create a foreign war or go to war in foreign lands, and everyone hasn't really got any option but to all pull together for that. And he had had the dream, and perhaps the prospect, of leading all Western Europe into the high championship of a crusade. He never did, incidentally. Council and Parliament alike showed themselves suddenly bent on war with France. End quote. So, just to give you some context, some of the dates involved. Henry becomes king in 1413, and the Battle of Agincourt is in 1415. And it takes a good year to get everything ready for such a big campaign. So, in other words, you can see there that straight away, pretty much straight away, he's already made the decision and starts the process of events which lead to war in France, with France, straight away. And there are lots of reasons for it. One, we just mentioned, the idea that to take people's minds off internal strife or internal political weakness even, is that you confront an external threat. So there's that. But there's also this idea of legitimacy as well. Henry V knew that his father was a usurper and that everyone knew that. He knew that they knew. They knew that he knew they knew, and so on. So it's a shadow that he has to sort of deal with or can never be completely free of. So one way to do that, to show the world that your reign is legitimate in the eyes of God, is to go out and win a war. In the medieval mind, I've already mentioned this in one of the previous episodes, that if you're successful in war, it was because God and the heavens wanted it that way. And if you fail, for the same reason, God wanted it that way. So to sort of prove that his dynasty is legitimate, or has got the sanction of heaven, is to go and fight a war with the French and win. Of course, you're gambling then, aren't you? Because you might lose. Of course, you might lose. So you're gambling with everything, perhaps even your own life, but certainly with your legitimacy and with your honour, with your reputation. But Henry V, like all great men in history, is a gambler. You sort of have to be. Someone like Genghis Khan or Caesar or Napoleon endlessly gambled with everything, went all in, all the time. So Henry V is doing that. One of the other reasons is that it seems France was at a particularly low ebb. If the kings of England did ever want to bounce across the channel back into France and start foreshaying all over the place and having Crecy-style battles again, this would be the time to do it because France is at such a weak and low ebb. I'll talk about that in a moment in some detail. But Britain, England doesn't even control the channel, really. The Royal Navy exists. There is a Royal Navy, but it's very, very small. It's certainly not what it comes to be in centuries, you know, all powerful, world spanning, and there's absolutely no contest in the channel. Of course, the Royal Navy controls the English Channel. Well, we're just not at that point in history yet. And so there's tons and tons of piracy, quote unquote, piracy in the English Channel. But what it really is French sponsored privateers, what in later centuries would end up being called privateers. In other words, pirates, you know, someone like Drake, Sir Francis Drake, a type of pirate, but with the sanction of the state. So don't even really control the channel properly. So it feels like things need to be done. If we're ever going to kick off the Hundred Years' War again with sort of hot war, then this period, as far as the French are concerned, would be the time to do it. Strike while the iron is hot. But let me read a paragraph from Sir Charles Oman, his opening paragraph on Henry V. He wrote this, quote, "Henry of Monmouth had a far easier task before him when he ascended the throne than his father had been forced to take in hand. He had the enormous advantage of succeeding to an established heritage and was no mere usurper legalised by parliamentary election." That belies the fact that he's still the heir to a usurper. In a lot of people's minds, that's not much better. Anyway, Oman goes on. "So firm did he feel himself upon his seat that he began his reign by releasing the young Earl of March, the legitimate heir of Richard II, whom Henry IV had always kept in close custody." That's the children, the descendants of Lionel of Antwerp, the second son of Edward III. So really, yeah, the Earls of March are really ahead of the House of Lancaster. But there we go. All that will come up in the next generation. For he knew that none of the odium of his father's usurpation rested upon him. That's a rosy take from Professor Sir Charles Omar there. Very rosy. And that he was well liked by the nation, although that does seem fair. Nor was his popularity ill-deserved. Though only 25 years of age, he was already a tried warrior and an able statesman. His life was sober and orderly, inclining rather towards Spartan rigour than display and luxury. He was grave and earnest in speech, courteous in all his dealings, and an enemy of flatterers and favourites. His sincere piety bordered on asceticism. If he had a fault, it was that he was somewhat overstern with those who withstood him. Like his great ancestor Edward I, his enemies called him hard-hearted and sanctimonious. End quote. So it's clear to see then, isn't it? It's clear to say that he was quite a serious person, very pious, very warlike, already experienced when he comes to the throne, still relatively young, but completely a grown man with his own mind. So formidable, I think the word is, formidable. To underestimate him wouldn't be a great idea, which is one of the things the French do, try and dismiss him as still just a boy or something. No, there's no real doubt that he's got all the tools he needs to achieve great things. He just has to actually do it. Okay, so before I carry on, I do want to take a few minutes out to talk about the religious side of things, because it has to be mentioned if we're going to paint the world in which Henry V and the Battle of Agincourt occurred. I have to at least for a moment talk about religious affairs. If I get it out of the way now, hopefully I won't have to return to it very often. So there's two big things to mention. There's on the domestic front in England, as far as Henry is concerned, the Lollards, and then there's the broader, wider picture of the Catholic Church in Europe, certainly Western Europe, and the fact that there's multiple popes. So I'll address those two things. So first of all, then, in England, with the followers of Wycliffe and the Lollards, if you remember before, they're sort of a proto-Protestants. It's like a Protestant movement before Protestantism, something like that. People that have got questions and queries and concerns about the way the Catholic Church is doing things. The Lollards. Why they're called Lollards, no one's entirely sure. There's various different schools of thought why that is, but no one's really sure. Anyway, the followers of Wycliffe, Lollards. So Henry, if you remember in the last episode, had been relatively kind to them because, you know, on paper, they're heretics. On paper, they're sort of, they're schismatics, strictly by the letter of the law. They should be hung or burnt for their crimes, for their blasphemies. But because the things they were saying were really quite reasonable and people had been complaining about the very same things for centuries, that they usually weren't burnt or persecuted all that badly. Henry IV had looked relatively kindly on them, certainly didn't try to any sort of extremely harsh repression or massacres of them or anything like that. And when Henry V had been Prince of Wales, he'd also had friends that were Lollards. And if you remember last time I mentioned, there was that one incident where he tried to spare a Lollard, tried to give him every opportunity to sort of repent. The guy didn't. But so everyone thought that Henry would be sympathetic to the Lollards, but it turns out he wasn't. Rather, it's probably one of two things. One, it's a political gambit that he just needs everyone to be united under one thing. And so going with orthodoxy is the easiest. And the other angle is that maybe, probably, he was just genuinely orthodox himself, just genuinely wanted to remain completely loyal to Rome. So probably both those things. So I'll read a paragraph from Oman on that. He says this, quote, "Henry's piety and his love of order and orthodoxy were a source of much trouble to the unhappy Lollards. From the moment of his accession, he bore very hardly upon them and redoubled the severity of the persecution which his father had begun." A mild persecution there. So Henry ramps it up quite massively, to be honest. People didn't think he was going to do that. "He did not spare even his own friends, but arrested for heresy Sir John Oldcastle, Lord of Cobham, who had been one of his most trusted servants. When accused of holding the doctrines of Wycliffe, Oldcastle boldly avowed his sympathy for them, spoke scornfully of the papacy and its claims, and taunted his judge, Archbishop Arundel, with all the sins and failings of the clergy. He was condemned to be burnt, but escaped from the Tower and hid himself in the Marches of Wales. Long afterwards, he was retaken and suffered bravely for his opinions. Henry's ill-treatment of the Lollards drove the unfortunate sectaries to despair. Some of the more reckless of them planned to put an end to their sufferings by seizing the king's person and compelling him to relax the persecution. They tried to stir up a popular rising like that of Wat Tyler, but Henry got timely notice of their plot. When they began to assemble by night in St. Martin's Fields outside the gates of London, he came suddenly upon them with a great body of horse and scattered them all. 40 were hung next day as traitors, and for the future they were treated as guilty of treason as well as of heresy. End quote. Okay, so Henry makes a decision just to go full bore pro-Rome, anti-Lollard. And so in some ways, at least in England, the protesting movement against the church is put back in its box for a while. The story is quite different, though, in mainland Europe. So I want to talk all about the Council of Constance. That happens in 1414, so 1 year into Henry's reign. So the Council of Constance is quite a big thing. It's a really quite important moment in time. And what it is an ecclesiastical, what they used to call a synod, or council of all the most important people, religiously speaking. And they all come to this small town called Constance, right in the middle of Europe, above the Alps, in and around modern-day Switzerland, it would be, I think. And it's this small town of only 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 people. And thousands, maybe 10,000, maybe more, people descend on it to try and figure out a lot of the problems that are happening in the church. So even before I describe that, I have to give you a little bit of a backstory of what's been going on with the Catholic Church. As I say, people had been complaining about various problems already for centuries. People like the Albigensians, for example, the followers of Wycliffe. For a long time, people have said all sorts of things like, "What? It's just not fair that the church in Rome controls so much land and taxes people, and they spend it on gold, and there's the abuses of bishops, all sorts of things. Bishops aren't supposed to be rich, or they're not supposed to extort people. There have been all sorts of abuses. You know, bishops would take many, many wives or lovers. They're not supposed to, right? They're supposed to be married to the church, supposed to be celibate, but it just wasn't being observed. Or they could be cruel, murderous even, acting like secular rulers. All sorts of abuses, most things you can think of. So like a bishop is supposed to be a very serious role, but they would just outsource all the actual work to somebody else, some underling, and they would just sit at the top of this pyramid collecting all the taxes with the name of bishop, but not doing any of the work. That's not right, is it? And that bishop might not even know anything about the Bible. He might not be acting in a pious way whatsoever. Things like this have been going on for generations already. No wonder when it gets to the age of Luther, so the 16th century, there was already a giant swell of popular feeling. It had been there for centuries and had been repressed for centuries. And there's only so long you can keep the lid on that pressure cooker. So, okay, back in the late 14th century, in like the late 1370s, there had been a new pope elected in Rome. But there was some question over coercion. See, this is a classic example of the sorts of problems that are going on in the Catholic Church in the 14th century, is that there seems to have been lots and lots of corruption surrounding the election of the new pope. There's all sorts of power plays and bribery and blackmail and just physical intimidation even. So at the election of this new pope in, 1378, the cardinals, the curia, are supposed to vote on who's the new pope. And they voted, but as soon as the vote was over and this new pope was elected, some of the cardinals were saying, "Look, that wasn't even fair. We were intimidated into voting a certain way. There was a mob outside in Rome, a mob, and we had to vote that way, otherwise we might have been torn limb from limb. So that wasn't fair. The election we just had there, even though it was all sort of squared away by the letter of the law, it wasn't actually fair." And it gets even deeper than that. So, for example, everyone knew that if you could control the Pope, or even just enough cardinals, it would make you extremely powerful. So you could have actual secular leaders, some duke from Germany or Italy or from anywhere, could bribe a cardinal or a pope or blackmail them or intimidate them, have them in his pocket one way or another, then that would make him extremely powerful. So there's that going on as well. There's all sorts of rulers all over mainly Central and Eastern Europe and Italy that vied for control of popes. So there's many, many layers to this. And least of all, if you're just a normal pious person in Germany or Spain or Ireland or Scotland or wherever, you see all this going on and you're sort of disgusted by it, right? You think, this isn't what Christ had in mind. This isn't what the apostles had in mind. none of this is in the Gospels. This is all sort of dirty, corrupt power plays. And I want to get back to sort of a more honest, pure religiosity. What's going on in Rome is horrible. So, okay, there was this Pope that a big faction of the cardinals said shouldn't be the legit Pope. So long story short, could go into this. If you're interested, it's called the Western Schism, or sometimes the Papal Schism, not to be confused with the Great Schism, which is when the Eastern and the Western Church broke apart. But the Western Schism. So another Pope gets elected. A bunch of cardinals say, look, that Pope just isn't the real Pope. He doesn't have the mandate of heaven. We're going to break off and just elect somebody else, which is what they do. And there's a town in southern France called Avignon, and they elect another Pope at Avignon. So now there's two popes. There's the Roman Pope and the Avignon Pope. And so for a long time, 30 odd years, there's these two popes, both claiming they're the real Pope and that the other one is an imposter, well, not an imposter, an anti-Pope. He's a pretender. And it does split the church and Europe fairly cleanly. So broadly speaking, the French and the Spanish usually broadly support the Avignon Pope. And the Italians and the Germans broadly often support the Roman Pope. England and Scotland and Ireland vacillate. Henry IV didn't come out strongly, particularly one way or the other, although it was basically orthodox. But now we've got Henry V, he comes out strongly on the side of the Roman Pope. But there's more to it than that. So in, what was it, something like 1409, there's a new council at Pisa in Italy, Leaning Tower of Pisa, They call a council where they try to get to the bottom of everything. So there's been two popes running around for a couple of decades and nobody's happy with it. Right? Not just the normal pious person, but everyone is sort of sick of it. They decide we really need to sort this out. It's, apart from anything else, it's sort of embarrassing, isn't it? The Pope is supposed to be like Christ's representative on earth. He's supposed to be Christ's vicar and to be appointed, chosen by God himself. It's just a blaring contradiction, a glaring problem to have more than one of them at any given time. So for everyone's sake, they decide they'll all come together in a giant council, like the councils of old, like the Council of Nicaea or something, 1,000 years earlier, and hash it out and come to some sort of conclusion. So they call this big council at Pisa in, I think, 1409. And what they decide is that what might be a good solution to all of this would be to delegitimize both these popes and pick a new one, a third claimant to the Holy See. And then that will please everyone. Right? Well, no, not at all. That's what they do. They pick a third pope, now called like the Pisan Pope. So you've got the Roman Pope, the Avignon Pope, and now the Pisan Pope, who's a John the 23rd. It's a bit confusing because there's another, because he becomes illegitimized himself later. And then there's another Pope John the 23rd in the 20th century. So there's two Pope John the 23rds. But anyway, this early 15th century one, it's a bit odd. His brothers were pirates. Had been pirates and captured and executed. And there was questions over his early life, whether he'd been a pirate, but he was backed by the Medici. He'd been a cardinal. He was backed by the Medici, extremely rich and powerful faction. So the idea that if we pick this third guy, that will solve the issue. No, it just muddies the waters even further. So now there's three popes because the other two popes don't accept him. So it's just got much worse. So now this is just getting really embarrassing, is descending into almost a farce, and no one's really happy with it. So by 1414, they decide, okay, that didn't work. We'll come together again for an even bigger council, and we will get to the bottom of it this time, come hell or high water. So that's what they do. They call this Council of Constance to deal with not just the problem of having three popes, but also all the other main concerns that people have been having for a long time. You know, let's make sure that our bishops and our vicars aren't just greedy men who know nothing about religion. Let's make them actually pious and take their ecclesiastical offices seriously. Let's have that. Let's start doing that. Let's put processes in place to make sure that's the case. Let's make sure they're not sort of unjustly taxing their people. Let's make sure that they're not just trying to hoard money and land and power for the sake of it. Let's make sure they're not raping nuns. Right? Things as serious as this. Let's make sure that, you know, the Clean Up Our Act, basically. So at the Council of Constance, usually you would think that it would take a few weeks, a month or two, you know, perhaps a summer to get this done. But it takes 4 years. They're there for like 3.5, 4 years before they can sort it all out. And even the Battle of Agincourt happens whilst it's still going on. But what they decide is they'll elect a fourth pope. And long story short, it sort of works, kind of, not exactly. The Avignon Pope refuses to accept it, but the other two do. And the Pope John the 23rd is put in prison for a while and then released and allowed to be a cardinal in Rome again. And then this sort of semi-exile back to Florence. And it's all a bit messy. And I won't go into it in a fantastic amount of detail here because it's not really strictly necessary for our story of Henry V. But the point is that the Roman Church is, or Christendom in the West, in Western Europe, is in a state of turmoil. But this Council of Constance, which happens here, begins to start sorting it out.
If you'd like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.